from the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. One of the United States' closest allies in the Middle East is a group of people that don't even have their own country. I'm talking, of course, about the Kurds, an ethnic group of around 30 million people that is spread across Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. Now, the Kurds fought with the U.S. in both wars against Saddam Hussein, and that helped them gain their own autonomous region in northern Iraq. But the Kurds have also played a key role in the Syrian war. With U.S. military aid, a Kurdish militia called the YPG has done a large share of the ground fighting that has led to the near defeat of the Islamic State. Still, it's not clear that these military gains have brought the Kurds any closer to their dream of a Kurdish nation. In Syria, Kurdish militias have fought not just ISIS and the Russian-backed Assad regime, but now are also battling the U.S.'s NATO ally, Turkey. On this edition of Global Journalist, a look at the future for the Kurds after the defeat of the Islamic State. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a great panel of guests who have been following this issue closely. But first, we're going to hear about some human rights issues in northern Iraq and what Kurdish forces and the Iraqi government are doing with thousands of captured ISIS fighters. For that, we're joined by Belkis Vil. She's a senior Iraq and Qatar researcher for Human Rights Watch. She's traveling now, but joins us via Skype from Kiev, Ukraine. Belkis, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us, if you would, what do we know about how many former ISIS fighters are being held now as prisoners, and who's holding them?
There are thousands of men and boys being held, allegedly because they were ISIS members. They're held by a range of different forces within Iraq and within the northern part of Iraq, within the Kurdistan region of Iraq. In the area of Nineveh, the governorate where you have the city of Mosul, in that governorate alone, we know of about 20,000 men and boys being held prisoner because they were allegedly members of ISIS. When we speak specifically about the Kurdish regional government and Kurdish forces, they're also holding thousands of individuals. Theoretically, we'll bring charges against all of them under counterterrorism legislation. But we have documented many instances in which both Iraqi and Kurdish forces are actually executing these individuals after they've been detained either on or near the battlefield.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I believe your group just documented an execution of many, many suspected ISIS fighters or captured ISIS fighters in the Kurdish region. Tell us about what happened there.
In late August of last year, we saw sort of the winding down of the battle against ISIS in the area of Mosul and a city near to Mosul called Tel Afar. In that city, we knew that there were a very large number of ISIS fighters still alive and still fighting. And what was significant was that there was a large number of foreign fighters as well as Iraqi fighters. And in addition to them, they had their families around them, their wives and their children. In late August, a large number of them decided to surrender themselves to Kurdish forces that were to the north of the area where they were embattled. And in the context of that, women and children were separated from their men. And women and children were then bused to a camp and from there onto a prison. And we've actually interviewed some of these women. The men, on the other hand, were taken by Kurdish forces, held in a prison, and then executed over a period of about a week, with executions of maybe between 80 and 150 men every single night. We issued a report because we were finally able to find this large mass grave site where we believe most of the bodies have been buried.
And what has been the response of the Kurdish regional government to this report?
We contacted a spokesman of the government before we issued our report, asking for clarification based on our findings. And at that point, we got an absolute denial that these executions happened. Of course, this is a very serious allegation, and what we're talking about is a war crime. Subsequent to the publishing of our report, it is noticeable that nothing else has come out from the Kurdistan Regional Government by way of an allegation that these facts of ours are incorrect. And in fact, in an interview I did on local TV with a Kurdish spokesman also present, he said that there is a chance these executions took place. And if they took place, it would have been at the orders of a lower level commander, and that an investigation is needed. So that's the last statement that we've gotten at this time.
Well, you just spoke about this sort of atrocity, a mass killing, really, of people who are prisoners. What is the sort of legal process for the people that are still being held? You talk about tens of thousands of people, both in Iraq and in the Kurdish regional government's custody. How are they being tried? How are those governments trying to distinguish between who is sort of a senior figure and who is maybe a cook or a driver?
Unfortunately, the approach that's been taken by both Baghdad authorities and the Kurdistan regional government is one of applying the counterterrorism law, a law that is very broad in the way that it's framed, allows for prosecution of anyone who did anything in support of a terrorist organization like ISIS. And they're using this really as a catch-all. They're bringing charges that lead to life in prison, potentially the death penalty, or lower sentencing, but still significant periods of time in prison for anyone who is alleged to have assisted ISIS. And they don't differentiate between, for example, a senior commander, a fighter, and then a cook or a child who worked at a checkpoint for ISIS. And in fact, we've documented many, many cases where cooks, doctors, children who were ISIS are being given life prison, life sentences or the death penalty.
Well, I wanted to just shift gears for a moment and ask you about Kurdish efforts at creating their own state. Iraqi Kurdistan did hold an independence referendum in September. People voted overwhelmingly for independence from Iraq, but it doesn't seem to have actually brought them any closer to independence. Can you tell us just a little bit about what's happened?
Yes, of course, as Human Rights Watch, we don't get involved in politics and don't comment on political developments. For us, the key question in the context of the referendum was A, whether people were able to continue to maintain free movement. And that's in the context of, you know, an area between Baghdad authorities and the Kurdistan regional government that for many years has been known as the disputed territories. And a lot of it has been de facto under Kurdish control since the advent of ISIS. And now, after this referendum was held, we saw Baghdad forces coming in and re-exerting control in those disputed territories. So our real concern was that citizens living there, whether Arab or Kurdish or Turkmen or any other minority, would have the ability to stay and live comfortably and safely in their homes, and they would not lose the right to free movement. What we did see right after the referendum and after this push to re-exert control by Baghdad was that in one town in particular, a town called Tuz, an area where for many years there has been extreme tension and violence between the Kurds, the Turkmen, and the Arabs who all live there. There we saw Baghdad-backed forces coming in, destroying houses of Kurdish officials, carrying out looting of Kurdish neighborhoods. And unfortunately, that continued for quite some time.
Well, Belkis Vile, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Global Journalist. Today, we're talking about the war in Syria and Iraq with a special focus on the Kurds, the U.S.'s main ally in the conflict. We just heard from Belkis Vile of Human Rights Watch about the situation in northern Iraq. To broaden our discussion, we're going to bring in three other people who have been following Kurdish issues closely. Joining us from Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan, is Nafisa Konavard. She's a correspondent for the BBC World Service. In Tel Aviv is Cheng Sagnik. He's the coordinator of the Kurdish Studies Program at the Moshe Dayan Center, an Israeli think tank. And in Washington, D.C. is Mutlu Siviroglu. He's a Kurdish affairs analyst and journalist who's written for outlets including The Guardian and The Voice of America. Welcome to all of you. Let me start with you, Nafisa Konavard. There has been a lot of news in recent days about the fighting in this town in northern Syria called Afrin, and that's where this Kurdish militia called the YPG, one of the U.S.'s main allies on the ground there, has been fighting the Turkish military, which is, of course, a NATO military ally of the U.S. Tell us what you know about this battle, what some of the risks are of this conflict.
Jason, I just came back of covering that for BBC. I was at the border when the Turkish army started that assault. The fact is that the Afrin situation was very different of other cantons Kurdish cantons inside Syria. They had a kind of special relation with Russians, and still a part of Russian military are there. They were so close to the government, and they were not fighting with the government, and they were not working with each other, but sometimes even they were helping the government or government allies forces against opposition, armed opposition around Afrin. So their situation is very complicated. And also,
so the specific militia in Afrin then has closer relations with the Assad government and with Russia than some other Kurdish factions then.
But at the same time, a part of them, they were getting help from Americans. So that makes the Afrin situation so specific. And the issue that why Turkey started that assault, they say that they were getting attack from the other side of the border, and Turkish cities on the border, they have been shelled by supposedly by YPG or YPG, and also they were saying that they are sending arms to affiliated group of PKK inside Kurdish area in Turkey. That's the reason that Turkey said that they started this attack, and they don't want to let any kind of a band of a Kurdish area to be created on the border with Turkey. But as I said, Afrin is very different. That's why right now no one can find any solution.
Well, let me just move this to Sang Sagnik, because you did cover a lot of ground there. And Sang, we heard Nafisa talking about a couple different groups, the YPG in Syria, the PKK, a different Kurdish group inside Turkey. Give us just a little bit of an overview of these different groups and their relations with the international community, because it sounds like the one major group in Turkey, the PKK, Turkey regards as a terrorist group. The U.S. officially listed as a terror group. In Syria, the YPJ is considered an ally of the U.S., but an enemy of the U.S.'s ally, Turkey. So help unpack this for us.
Well, it's not technically possible to call the YPJ part of the PKK or PKK network at the moment, or the PYV, but it's definitely an extension of the Kurdish nationalist movement of Turkey. What brought the Kurdish nationalist movement of Turkey to bring about an extension of itself in northern Syria during the Syrian crisis was its capabilities of transferring its experience and structural network from Turkey to Syria in 2011. At the moment, the YPG, the PYD, and other Kurdish-led organizations in northern Syria and the Kurdish regions of this country are acting autonomously. That is to say, there might be some PKK presence within these organizations or in their environs, cooperating with them, but it's technically not possible to call it a PKK extension into Syria. That is mostly because the PKK might have its very own independent presence in northern Syria without the YPG and the PYD, its own command structure and its own organizational capabilities in this country. And in the meantime, the groups that are basically based in the Afrin region are actually parts of the Syrian Democratic Forces, but outside the Afrin region. That is to say, the Syrian Democratic Forces is a U.S.-allied Kurdish-led force that is consisting of several groups, including the Kurdish-led YPG and the YPJ. But the YPG and YPJ are also in charge of Afrin, where the invasion is ongoing. But that's not the SDF, not under the SDF command.
Well, Mutlu Siviroglu, I understand that you do have some family in the area where this fighting is taking place between Kurdish forces and Turkish forces. Sounds like it could be potentially quite explosive. What are you hearing about what's happening there right now?
Jason, what I hear is the indiscriminate shelling of civilian areas are ongoing. The city of Afrin is a home to hundreds of thousands of people. The towns, villages are being shelled, hit by airstrikes. So civilians are in great danger. The resources for life are targeted. For example, the dam, the main dam in Afrin area, has been hit recently. Also, water resources, cemeteries, schools, hundreds of schools are closed. 40,000 students are not able to go to school now. So the problem in overall Afrin area is that people are being attacked. The operation, not only limited to the combatants, but the civilians, children, elderly, women. There have been some Western reports recently, AFP, CNN, Guardian, VOA, Al Hurra. It's established that the civilians are in great danger. Even yesterday, 8 members of U.S. Congress, they released a letter asking Secretary of State Tillerson to touch this issue. So Afrin is in this such situation is pretty dire. But before that, I would like to clarify something. Nobody can give an answer why this operation, invasion of Turkey, has started. Really, Turkey has been saying that it has been under attack. Or like Nafisa mentioned, there are allegations that weapons have been transferred to the PKK inside Turkey. But we have not seen any proof, any audio or video material that's showing this. So it's clearly, I'm not convinced that there is a real justification, there is a just reason for Turkey to do such an operation. Because Afrin has been one of the most stable parts of Syria. There are, like I say, there are 2 IDP camps. People from different parts of Syria sought refuge in Afrin. So there are over 1 million people living in Afrin.
Well, Mutlu, you raise some good points here. And I want to turn this to Nafisa Konavard, because Mutlu did mention Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's efforts to try to mediate this. I understand that he is traveling to Turkey to try to find some sort of solution here. Talk to us about what the U.S. can do. What has the U.S. government been saying about fighting between 2 of its allies?
It is one of the most complex situations, I think, that the U.S. is experiencing since the situation in Syria went worse, and it's almost 7 years. So, but recently, this is the most complicated situation that Americans trying to sort out, but it is not really easy, because at the one side, as you said, it's a NATO allies, and the other side, the group that they were fighting alongside for against ISIS. But it was interesting that today I read in one of the Turkish newspaper that apparently Americans are suggesting something like drawing line between PKK and YPG to prove to Turkey that YPG is not a group, a part of PKK. And also they offered, according to some Turkish official, they offered to use YPG or YPG against PKK, which is impossible. If they really suggested
so
that...
So the Americans are trying to draw a bright line between these 2 Kurdish groups.
It is not, yes, but it is not really easy. It is not possible. If you have a look to pictures when they took Raqqa recently, a few months ago, and you can see Öcalan's picture, the leader of PKK. It was the most, you know, the biggest picture that you could see in the main square of Raqqa was Öcalan's picture. So Turkey is giving these pictures to Americans to prove that they are part of PKK. It is kind of, and Americans are insisting that they are not part of PKK, but Turkey is preparing, according to officials again, they are preparing to hand over something like 79 pages documents to Americans, to Tillerson himself specifically, to prove that they are the same as PKK and they expect that Americans should fight them, not help them, which is impossible.
Well, and this is quite complicated because there are also American military advisors on the ground in northern Syria right alongside some of these YPG forces, as you mentioned. But I just want to remind our listeners that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's show, we're talking about the role of the Kurds in conflict in Syria, Iraq, and Turkey. We're joined by Nafisa Konavard of the BBC World Service in Iraqi Kurdistan, Seng Sagnik of the Moshe Dayan Center in Israel, and Mutlu Siviroglu, a Kurdish affairs analyst in Washington, D.C. If you're interested in more Global Journalists, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues, including a series of recent interviews with international journalists forced to flee their home countries. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, or check out our videocast on YouTube. And Seng Sagnik, just to pull back from this Kurdish issue for a moment, you are in Israel, and in recent days, Israel has launched some airstrikes into Syria as well, targeting Assad regime forces there. What's going on? Why is Israel joining the fray?
Well, Israel has tried very hard to stay away from the Syrian conflict, but with the expansion of Iran's military capabilities to the south and southwest of Syria, coupled with provocations, including infiltration of Israeli airspace, has airstrikes by Israel on multiple positions in homes. It's not a full-fledged war yet, and nobody expects this to turn into an invasion of Syria by Israel anytime soon, as long as those Iranian-backed militias, the Iranian military and the Syrian Arab army stay away from the Israeli border and refrain from sending drones into Israel.
But still, this must be, I mean, it sounds like a kind of a dangerous situation. Once bombs start falling, it's sometimes not as easy to stop the fighting as you might expect.
It is definitely a very dangerous situation because this time marked the first time that it was a very open provocation by allegedly Iranian-backed entities in Syria. A large-sized drone infiltrated Israeli airspace, triggering Israeli F-16s to follow it to Homs. And on their way back to Israel, they were attacked by air defense systems. It definitely shows that Iran's access to these areas, to the southwest, it has reached its limit. And previously, it was always commented that Iran was the mediator, actually, trying to calm Hezbollah and its other proxies not to provoke tensions with Israel while the war in Syria is ongoing. But definitely it's now the time when almost a victory is declared against the rebels and ISIS and other Islamist organizations. So tensions are very much likely.
Well, this sounds like it's very much complicating the situation in southern Syria. Mutlu Siviroglu, if I could turn you back to northern Syria and Turkey, where the fighting around Afrin has been the Turkish military attacking what they consider to be, you know, Kurdish PKK targets there. Give us just a little bit of background about why there is such hostility now between the Turkish government and the Kurds and the PKK. A decade ago, President Erdogan, then when he was prime minister, had been conducting some outreach. It seemed like there was a track for peace between the Kurds and the Turks, and all that changed.
There has not been PKK in Afrin. Afrin is ruled by Afrini people with the local government, and with, like Cenk mentioned, YPG, which is part of SDF. So people of Afrin, there are Yazidis, Alevis, Christians, Arab, Turkmens, Kurds, in addition. So they were living in harmony. Also, that it was a home for tens of thousands, you know, refugees from different parts of the Syria. This has to be seen like this. But Mr. Erdogan, like you mentioned, not a decade ago, just 3 years ago, there was a peace process in Turkey, and Mr. Erdogan's government was involved in peace process with PKK. So, but that process was ended, and since then, Turkey has sharpened its rhetoric, and Turkey has been. Using military operations again. This is not against PKK. There is a sharp policy towards all Kurds. Let's remember Iraqi Kurdish referendum. Turkey has been the main power to prevent this referendum. Kurds are people in Middle East, they just want basic rights. They want whatever the Farsi, the Arabs, Armenians, Turks have. They don't want anything more than that. They just want a decent life, basic rights. But unfortunately, Turkey has been seeing any modest, any small Kurdish demand as a threat. That's why Turkey has been very harsh on Kurds generally, Kurds within its own borders, Kurds in Iraq, and recently Kurds in Syria. So Kurds, they have always wanted good relations. Iraqi Kurds, they had wonderful relations with Turkey until recently. And Syrian Kurds, I have interviewed them, you know, hundreds of times. They always wanted good relations with Turkey. They want Turkey to come into their market. They want Turkish companies to come there. They want to export their goods through Turkey. So Kurds are not threat for Turkey. On the contrary, Kurds have been involved.
Well, clearly the Turkish government sees things differently. But Nafisa Konavard, if I could go to you, our time does grow short. But you were speaking about Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's dialogue with the Turkish government about the fighting in northern Syria. What do you see that Western countries should be doing? What are some opportunities to help untangle the conflict now that has become so complicated with so many outside actors involved?
Well, it is so difficult, especially if we have a look to what happened in Iraqi Kurdistan as well. I think the problem is that first, they didn't decide, these Western countries, they didn't decide that what they are going to do with Kurds after 3 years of fighting with ISIS. They gave them training, they gave them ammunition, they gave them arms, and they gave them that impression that they have been recognized as a completely separate nation of the countries that they live in. So, and right after that, they started to ask the same right that they were asking for a long time. They turned their back to them. This is the feeling that you can hear here in streets. And even if you go to Turkey, Kurdish areas, you can hear the same thing. They feel, Kurds generally feels that Americans and Western countries, they betrayed them. This is the main feeling that they have. But I have to add something to Cenk's comments that it is not black and white. The peace process in Turkey, for example, is started very well. I was in Turkey that time. I was covering that story, and I saw many things that once upon a time, it was just a dream seeing, you know, people dancing Kurdish, people singing Kurdish. Everything was going very well. And suddenly everything started to change because from both sides, there are groups that they don't want this peace. And the same thing now is about the whole picture about Kurds, that in all areas, no matter regional or international countries, they don't want to let them, and it is not easy to let them, because all areas that Kurds are living is mixed areas. You cannot draw a line. You cannot just cut it down and from one part of country like
I'm
Iraq,
sorry, Nafisa, we're just out of time. We're going to have to leave it there for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Belki Vil, Nafisa Konavard, Seng Sagnik, and Mudlu Sivaroglu for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Taylor Campbell, Jonathan Mitchell, and Blythe Nebaker, with supervising producer Lauren Wertman. Jiwon Choi is our visual editor. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Our director is Travis McMillan. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.